From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses the persistent policy, social, and civil rights issues affecting communities of color. I'm Jordan Lawrence, Senior Manager of Communications, and on this week's episode, I sat down with Mustafa Ali, Senior Vice President of Climate, Environmental Justice, and Community Revitalization for the Hip Hop Caucus, and Flint, Michigan Mayor Dr. Karen Weaver. We discussed environmental racism, which some are calling the new Jim Crow. Now, as you may know, discriminatory decision-making in the form of redlining and housing discrimination, poor infrastructure choices, and segregation have caused African Americans to live in neighborhoods that make them more vulnerable to a wide array of environmental conditions, which is why I'm so excited to be joined today by two powerhouses in the environmental justice movement. Mustafa brings decades of experience and knowledge to this conversation and will walk us through the many threats that minority and low-income communities face. Mayor Weaver has been a champion for the people of Flint during their ongoing water crisis, and she'll explain how Flint ended up in a crisis to begin with and how we can prevent it from happening in other cities. But before we get started, a message from Mark H. Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League.
I'm Mark Morial, and this is your To Be Equal moment. The Main Street Marshall Plan, the National Urban League's comprehensive blueprint for addressing lack of opportunity and economic inequality in America's urban communities, has been introduced as federal legislation by members of the Congressional Black Caucus. The Urban League has long advocated for a major national commitment to alleviate poverty and expand economic opportunities in America's most neglected communities. We urge modeling it on the Marshall Plan that eliminated widespread poverty in Western Europe following World War II. Our then executive director, Whitney Young, first proposed a domestic Marshall Plan in the 1960s. Elements of that proposal were incorporated into President Johnson's War on Poverty. Later, in 1990, Urban League President John Jacob urged Congress to shift $50 billion in defense spending, part of the so-called peace dividend, resulting from the end of the Cold War, into an urban Marshall Plan. The Congressional Black Caucus's Job and Justice Act, unveiled last Thursday at a news conference at the U.S. Capitol, represents the most inclusive legislation of the Main Street Marshall Plan, first proposed as part of the 2016 State of Black America and finalized in detailed form last year. Among its provisions are increased funding for programs that promote minority-owned businesses, federal aid for highway and other important transportation projects, including mass transit, funding the creation of more than 1.9 million jobs by addressing critical physical and digital infrastructure needs in schools, raising the federal minimum wage to $15, urging businesses contracted to rebuild infrastructure to actively recruit, hire, and provide on-the-job training to African-American men ages 18 to 39 through existing jobs, apprenticeship, and earn while you learn programs. These are just a few of the provisions of the Job and Justice Act based on the Main Street Marshall Plan. I urge you to check out the full Main Street Marshall Plan at stateofblackamerica.org or the full Jobs and Justice Act on cbc.house.gov. When we introduced the Main Street Marshall Plan a year ago, I said, it is now time for the nation to treat its urban communities and cities as the jewels that they are. This comprehensive plan to rebuild and accelerate the growth of America's urban communities will accelerate the growth and progress of the nation as a whole. Please contact your member of Congress on house.gov and urge him or her to support the Jobs and Justice Act. I'm Mark Morial, and this has been your To Be Equal moment.
And I'm here live at the Hip Hop Caucus with Mustafa Ali. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get started. So environmental racism is arguably the most important civil rights issue of our time, but it's the one with the least amount of attention being paid to it. Mm-hmm. What is the definition or your definition of environmental racism?
Well, environmental racism deals with the disproportionate impact inside of communities of color, low-income communities, and indigenous populations. In other words, the things that others don't want, they want to cite them in our communities. The lack of investment inside of our communities after they've been impacted is another part of this environmental equity, environmental justice, environmental racism definition. And these disproportionate impacts also extract wealth from our community. So for me, it is a number of different things dealing with housing, transportation, public health, environmental, and job creation. All of these things come together to create environmental injustices that continue to, unfortunately, impact our communities across the country.
Some are calling environmental racism the new Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. Could you give us a primer on how it's impacted communities of color historically?
Oh, my goodness. You know, it's funny. There are three sort of flashpoints that you can look at. One of them, for me, is when we came off of slave ships to our country and placed on plantations in some of the most dangerous jobs, taken away from our traditional food. So that is the food justice aspect of this. And then placed in the least desirable locations on the plantations. If you're an indigenous brother or sister, then you also know the similar dynamic of being taken away from your traditional lands. Again, placed in some very dangerous situations in the migrations that sometimes happen from one point in the country to a new point in the country. And even for our Asian American and Pacific Islander brothers and sisters, we can look at Chinese Americans who came and helped build the infrastructure in our country, especially the railroads. And again, placed in the most dangerous jobs, taken away from traditional cultural practices. And again, just dealing with the chemicals that they were exposed to. So we can look at a number of different groups who've come to our country, either, you know, willingly or unwillingly, and the situations that they were placed into. So that's one flashpoint, if you will. The other flashpoint for many folks is in Memphis, Tennessee, where Dr. King was there in 1968 for the sanitation workers. Many of those workers were placed in and dealing with some very extremely dangerous situations. Some of them actually had lost their lives and being exposed to different types of chemicals as a part of the, you know, the trash removal and other things. So for some folks, that is a flashpoint or one of those historical markers, if you will. The other one is in Warren County, North Carolina, which for many is the environmental justice flashpoint, where we had a African-American community, both middle and lower income working class communities, which we should point out. And the state of North Carolina had made a mistake and had sprayed some roadways with some PCBs, which are toxic chemicals, cancer causing chemicals, actually. And they had to find a place to dispose of them. They had a number of locations across the state of North Carolina, which were better fit and suited to receive that. But they chose the African-American community because they assumed that they had less power, less access, less influence. But folks stood up and pushed back against not just for their communities, but they understood also that they were fighting for future generations and other communities who look like them. And for us, those are some of those flashpoints that are important for people to have the historical context so that when you look at some of these impacts that are continuing to happen today, that you sort of have this bridge from the early 80s all the way now to 2018.
I'm actually from the state of North Carolina. I had never really heard of that story mm-hmm. until I was starting to do the research for this podcast. So that just goes to show how, you know, even those of us who may be more educated on these type of issues, it's still these stories that are so important mm-hmm. to truly understanding the history of it all.
Yeah, and I think that that's, you know, true for a lot of folks in our country. If they knew some of these egregious situations, mm-hmm. I can literally go across the country and share with you different stories, different communities fighting and having some success. I think that especially on the impact side, if our country knew that our citizens, taxpaying citizens, were being impacted the way that they are, that they would speak out and they would say that this is not American and this is not the way that we want to see our country moving forward in the 21st century.
In what ways does environmental racism impact urban communities differently than rural communities?
Well, there are some similarities because if you are a mother and your child has been exposed either to toxic chemicals, your child has asthma, you know, any of these types of things, then you just naturally want to make sure that your child is protected and that it does not happen again. of course, in our country, because we have some different dynamics going on, you know, so in the rural context, you may have CAFO, Certified Animal Feeding Operations. For those of us who come from a rural background, such as myself, we're talking about hog farms, talking about turkey farms, chicken farms. Anytime you have large amounts of animals coming together, there are going to be some impacts that are going to happen in that space.
Right.
There have been a number of African-American communities and others who have had to deal with this situation. Recently in North Carolina, you know, there was a case where folks finally, after years and years, were able to win a judgment against a major animal feeding operation. And it wasn't, it was in this situation, folks, and you have to go here and see what's actually going on. People literally can't breathe because of the huge amount of waste and the odors and other things that's given off, which helps to, you know, decline your quality of life, but also their water quality. So in the rural context, a lot of folks still get their water from wells. And in many instances, the water bodies have been impacted, or their local streams and rivers are impacted, so folks can't fish and other things. Folks might remember a few years ago, the big Fisteria scare that was going on. That came from, you know, the impacts that were going on from some of these animal feeding operations and the waste in the lagoons, you know, then making it out. You know, those lagoons are also interesting. I took Senator Booker with me on a tour of the Black Belt. And one of the things that he and I saw at that time were the spray fields. Now, a lot of folks don't know what the spray fields are, but if you're sitting on your porch, and what folks do is that waste that comes from animal feeding operations, in many instances, they then sort of utilize this spraying situation to play that out across the fields. And what you find is that when the winds shift, those mist that are filled with fecal waste and other things then end up spraying onto people's houses, onto their back porches and front porches, and creates a very, you know, just an unlivable type of a situation. I've talked to some of our elders who said that they used to be able to dry their clothes on lines. And now that these operations have come in, they can't do that because, you know, their clothing gets soiled.
Right.
So that's, you know, in the rural context, that's some of the things, along with fracking issues and the impacts that come from fracking and mountaintop mining for those folks who are in Appalachia. So we know, and that's our low income and working class brothers and sisters who are dealing with that situation. So those are some of the rural. On the urban side, anytime we're bringing large amounts of people together, we have to be very, very focused on making sure that the cities and areas that we're building, that there are less impacts. So we know that in many of the urban cities, you know, we have these huge high levels of asthma rates. So in our country, for those of your listeners who may not know, 25 million people suffer from asthma in our country, 7 million children, and disproportionately is African-American and Latino children who are the ones who end up in the emergency rooms and who unfortunately, in some instances, lose their lives. So when we have these traffic patterns, when we have these facilities that are located, whether incinerators or these other types of facilities, petrochemical corporations, all these different types of things that in many instances may be in somewhat in the location of these places, then you have these impacts that are going on. And we're now in an interesting time because we have an administration who is doing everything in their power to dismantle and deconstruct basic air protections. Those air protections that are critical for our communities, because we're the ones who get hit the hardest and the worst. But it's important for all of the folks inside of our country. And when you start playing around with the refinery rule, the methane rule, the clean power plan, all these things that are helping to lessen impacts in our communities and in relationship to the clean power plan, lessen that carbon that's going into the atmosphere that's creating these more intense storms. You know, when people talk about climate change, it's real for our communities because of the impacts that are happening. So both in the urban and rural context, there are real challenges, some slight differences, but it all comes down to human health and the environment. And are we helping communities to be a better and stronger place, or are we weakening them and putting them more in harm's way?
And this is such a multifaceted topic, because when people tend to think about environmental justice, they think about saving polar bears in the Arctic. But it has to do with access to transportation, whether you're going to be outside in the heat for long periods of time, having air conditioning in your house or things like that.
Exactly. You know, the environmental justice movement came into being because there wasn't a seat at the table for them in the larger and broader environmental movement. As you said, they wanted to focus more of a conservation lens, if you will. They were concerned with polar bears. They were concerned with the whales. They were concerned with ice caps. All those things are important. But if you are Mrs. Ramirez or Mr. Johnson, you want to know about what's happening in your community, the impacts that are happening, whether you are seeing them, tasting them, feeling them, and how there can be some resolution there. Right. You also are concerned with, you know, job creation. I hope we talk a little bit about that as we move forward also. And how does that intersect with these issues to make real change happen?
Prior to joining the Hip Hop Caucus, you worked at the EPA for 24 years and were integral in helping found their environmental justice program. Could you tell us a little bit about what the EPA is for those who may not know and what your role was there?
Well, the Environmental Protection Agency is the lead agency that is supposed to be focused on public health and the environment. That is it. When you are the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, your job is to protect human health and the environment for this country. If you are not doing that, then you should find a new job because you're not living up to the mandate and mission of that agency. I actually started there as a student, never thought in a million years that I would work for the government, but I was blessed that they were beginning to focus on environmental equity, which became environmental justice at that time. Dr. Clarice Gaylord and Dr. Warren Banks were two incredible folks who introduced me to the work that was going on, asked me if I would be interested in being a part of it. I had already, as a student, been focused on social justice issues, worker rights issues, those types of things, and came out of that along with a faith-based background. It was the perfect fit for me. Communities had always been my focus, and as many of us, and had the opportunity to be a part of the founding of the office, but to really watch the evolution of the federal government and beginning to pay more attention to the voices of communities. And again, I say the evolution because in the beginning, it was extremely difficult for communities to get anyone to pay attention. Mm. It was even more difficult for them to actually be able to get into a meeting, and even more difficult, if I can say it that way, for them to actually see their ideas and needs reflected in policy.
Right.
Now, I want you to remember something, and folks should also think about this in the context of where we are today. The Environmental Protection Agency and the other agencies and departments who have responsibility for many of the issues that are happening in our communities are utilizing your tax dollars. So they have a distinct responsibility to use those tax dollars, not to make your community be in a worse pace or space, but actually to be in a better place. I used to always think about that when I would see these folks working on policy, when I would work under all kinds of different administrations. And I would always ask myself, are these actions actually going to help people to be, you know, uplifted, or is this going to be more detrimental to their communities?
What impacted your decision to leave the EPA after being there for so long?
Well, you know, I was raised by folks in the environmental justice community. I'm extremely thankful, and I always uplift that, folks who came from civil rights background. And I knew that the actions that these folks were moving forward on were going to be detrimental to our communities. You have to remember, even under the best administrations, this issue of environmental justice always had to work extremely hard to get traction. I knew that the things that they were moving forward on in relationship to air and water issues and land issues like Superfund and brownfields and these types of things, that the way they were approaching them was going to definitely, unfortunately, cause folks in our communities to lose their lives prematurely. And I know this why. I know this because over 200,000 people die in our country every year prematurely from air pollution. So if you are trying to weaken air pollution, I know the communities who are more than likely are going to be disproportionately impacted. And if I know 200,000 are already dying and you're weakening things, then there's going to be even more.
Right.
And I can go down the list of the things that they were doing. So when I looked at that, and I prayed, I talked to mentors, I talked to my, you know, my family, and I decided that I could not be a part of this. So I stood up respectfully, submitted that letter, my resignation letter that reporters tell me over a million people read, and tried to point out to this administration, you know, the work that had happened before with communities and others helping to design tools and resources that they said they needed and that folks came together and helped create. I shared with them some of those offices that are critical for communities. But I also wanted to share with them those success stories, because if you can't point to the success stories, then sometimes folks, for
they
whatever
wonder what
reason,
the point is.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I shared that as well. And I moved on.
A major issue within the larger environmental justice movement is, of course, climate change. But this administration and many members of Congress have flat out denied that it exists. Mm-hmm. How will climate change continue to impact low-income and African-American communities in the future if we fail to act?
That's a great question. So all you have to do is look at communities like the Manchester community in Houston, Texas, primarily a working class Latino community who have all these petrochemical corporations inside of their community. So they had a whammy from that. And then when the hurricanes came through there in Texas, you know, the flooding that came, the displacement that comes, the Superfund sites that were breached because of the flooding and those toxins pushed all over the area. You could look at Port Arthur, Texas as well, right down the road there, primarily an African-American community, and them also having all these different types of facilities and the flooding and the storms that came through. Or you can look in Puerto Rico, where folks are still trying to recover. Or we can go back to Katrina in New Orleans, where I was the other day in a taxi and I was talking to a gentleman and he was telling me that his family was actually from New Orleans. And after the Hurricane Katrina came through, they were displaced. They lived in five different cities trying to find and still haven't been able to come back home. So in our communities, when we are impacted, because we have the lack of resources in many instances to rebuild sometimes or to come back home, culture is destroyed because families are broken apart. Organizations and entities are lost that have been traditional stalwarts inside of our communities. But also, we lose because of the lack of economic opportunities that exist also. So when these storms happen, I work both man-made and natural disasters. And I used to watch as when the cleanups would begin. So when the cleanups would begin, you know, lots of times all of the waste was moved into, you know, low income and communities of color. So that's another hit on the community. But also during the cleanup activities, others would move in and get the contracts. And then they would do the subcontracting opportunities to their friends and folks who they deal with.
Right.
And very, very few ever found an opportunity who were communities of color to be the contractors or subcontractors in that. So once again, not only do you deal with the impacts from the storms and the hurricanes and these wildfires and all these other things that are coming because the planet is warming up, but then you also lose again because you can't come back home, or if you can come back home, you can't get a job and you can't create businesses in this disaster economy that props itself up. So there are lots of changes that need to happen to make sure that our communities are not being disproportionately impacted and have opportunities in that space.
In what ways are states stepping in to sort of fill the gap mm-hmm. in what the administration and Congress may be failing to do?
There are some states that are doing some great work, even in these challenging times. So in relationship to sort of the Clean Power Plan and the Paris Agreement, you find that there are a number of states who have said that if the federal government won't live up to their responsibilities, we will fill that space. We will make sure that our cities and our states are more sustainable, more focused on resiliency, more focused on renewable energy into the mix. So that's a positive. And you find that on local government, county government, and on the state governments as well. But you also find that you have business and industries who are also saying that we see value in this. We understand what's coming. And many of them are now also lowering their carbon emissions as well, which is a real plus. But that does not take away from the distinct responsibility that both the president and his cabinet have to be addressing these issues. You can say all you want that climate change is not real. That is not impacting Mother Nature. She is still going to move forward and do what she's going to do.
Right.
So you can call it whatever you want to. It's almost like when people say, well, racism isn't real. Kanye, shout out to you for saying some silly things. But I mean, I want people to be real serious about this. You know, it's almost like when they say racism isn't real, or, you know, when President Obama came in and, you know, now we're past racism, we're past, you know, discrimination, these different types of things. That doesn't make those impacts that are happening any less real to folks who are out there dealing with those issues. The same thing with climate change. It's almost like if I could take you back a little bit before our time, you know, when folks used to have these conversations around cigarettes and they tried to tell you, well, yeah, you know, cigarettes don't cause cancer.
Right.
And then they began to say, well, it might cause cancer. And then the evolution was, well, yes, it does. And it's your choice if you want to move down this road. It's the same thing with these issues. They're just dusting off those old talking points. Everyone, 99% of the scientists say that climate change is real. We know that we have some technology. We know the steps that are necessary to lessen those impacts. And we also know that if we don't act, that we are going to pay a much higher price for, you know, some of the unfortunate things that are going to happen. And we also know who are the communities who are going to bear the brunt more from what's coming, both here domestically and internationally. There's a very similar dynamic internationally that poorer countries are going to have a much more more difficult time in being able to deal with these issues that are coming.
Right.
And we know that we are a global family. So if we are not putting in place now the steps and processes and actions that are going to be necessary, then we're going to have to help these other countries who unfortunately are going to be in an even worse situation than some parts of our country.
You touched on job creation a little bit earlier. And often when folks talk about the jobs of the future, they tend to focus on tech jobs. Mm-hmm. But what opportunities lie in the energy space, and how can African-American communities leverage mm-hmm. their opportunities to enter that space?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and one that I continue to sort of push people on. So we know that both wind and solar are the fastest growing industries that are out there. But we also know that in relationship to wind and solar, that very few African Americans actually own their own businesses or even have an intersection point into that. Now, there are some great, some great businesses that are out there. Volt Energy, which is owned by a couple of brothers who went to Howard University, Gilbert Campbell and his crew, and doing some incredible work in that space. Imani Energy is another one by Jeffrey Richards, who is also doing some incredible work. The NAACP, who recently launched their solar initiative. And you have folks in the faith-based world, like Reverend Leo Woodbury, who's from Florence, South Carolina, who's also been training dozens and dozens of folks on how to do solar installation. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is for folks who are in Appalachia and who are in the Rust Belt, who are looking for an economic opportunity. So we could do advanced manufacturing, which would give us the opportunity for all of those myriad of parts that go into the windmills for folks who are great with working with their hands and just looking for an opportunity. They could get engaged with that. And it's amazing. If you think about places like West Virginia, whom, you know, because of the lack of economic opportunities, you now have this huge opioid disaster right. that's going on. And in many instances, it's because people have lost hope, because they can't find a job, because the coal market has been dying for decades. And then natural gas recently kind of put the final nail in the coffin, if you want to say it that way. But if we began to move these opportunities into these areas for folks who are interested in continuing to be able to move up the ladder, this would be a perfect opportunity. But unfortunately, we have administrations, for whatever reason, that don't want to move into the 21st century, who don't want to give their folks an opportunity to succeed and to partake of this American dream that everybody talks about. And it just doesn't make sense. So we have some work to do there. But there's one more part to this. So the other part to this is that those folks who are in the green industry, the clean economy, they have a responsibility for a different paradigm. A paradigm that is more inclusive,
right.
A paradigm that is honoring all the voices inside of our country. And they have to make sure that they are reaching out, putting the internship fellowship programs, and also making sure that their leadership teams are reflective and look like America,
right.
And their boards.
Representation matters.
There it is.
So we may be facing some incredible obstacles when it comes to overcoming environmental racism, but there is hope. Tell mm-hmm. us about the work that you do here at the Hip Hop Caucus.
Well, the work here at the caucus is just incredible. I am so blessed to be here with Reverend Yearwood and the rest of the family. You know, we do a number of things. So we understand that the civic process is extremely important. Your vote has power. So we never tell anyone who to vote for, but we say, you know, you should be voting for somebody who cares about your community. So we have the Respect My Vote campaign. So that has registered over 600,000 folks to participate in the civic process. In many instances, young people, returning citizens, and others who sometimes are the ones that have been forgotten, mm-hmm. if you will, or haven't been invited into the process, if right. I can say it that way. And we utilize a number of our cultural influencers in that space. And we have had incredible folks who have been sort of our spokesmen over the years. We started off with T.I., and T.I. was just incredible. And Reverend Yearwood often shares a story of watching the evolution with him, of him not really knowing if he could vote, and then becoming an incredible spokesperson and getting so many folks engaged in the civic process. You know, we've had incredible folks, 2 Chainz, Wiz Khalifa. I mean, you know, so many incredible folks who are part of that. Charlemagne the God. And the importance of that is that people need to see folks who look like them, who come from the places, who've had some of the same experiences, who can then reach them. So, you know, super blessed that we have that. We also have People's Climate Music, which is just so powerful. If you think back to when Marvin Gaye was around and was kicking it, and you know how powerful his music was then and still today, you know, the ecology song, Mercy, Mercy Me, you know, and him almost being prophetic in the things he was talking about. And now we're still dealing with some of those. So now there's a new generation of artists who are using their platform to talk about civil rights issues, to talk about social justice issues, to talk about climate issues and environmental justice issues. You know, incredible folks like Antonique Smith, a Grammy Award winning, just a phenomenal sister. And you have folks, you know, everyone from Beyonce to Neo to Common. We put out Trouble in the Water when we were doing work in Flint, Michigan, to talk about what's going on. And, you know, when Common speaks, everybody listens because they know it's coming from a true and real place.
Right.
To all the great new artists, Vic Mensa, who's, you know, who's a part of some of the work that we do as well, and was with us at the March for Our Lives, actually came to the voter training that we did before the march. And Vic gave some very inspiring words, and he continues to use his music also. So there's so many folks. So, you know, we have that. And then we have the Revitalizing Vulnerable Communities program, which is focused on getting the resources and tools back into the hands of communities to make real change happen. You know, we often use the example of the Regenesis Project in Spartanburg, South Carolina, who took a $20,000 grant leveraged into $300 million in changes in their community that was labeled the other side of the tracks. You know, so, you know, we have a training institute that we're working with down there. And then recently we launched the Think 100 radio and podcast show. I'm so blessed to be on your show because this is a powerful medium, because it helps people to connect with information that maybe they didn't hear about, or folks who are out there doing the work that sometimes, you know, you don't see on MSNBC or right. CNN or some of these other shows. But they are still giving everything they got. So we utilize, you know, Think 100 to lift up young voices, to lift up innovators, and to help people to understand, you know, how folks are either moving in a positive direction and helping their communities, or those folks who unfortunately haven't evolved yet to a level of being and caring about our communities.
What is your call to action for the movement?
My call to action for the movement, one, is to understand that you have power and that you can make change happen. But there's also that the movement has to become more diverse. They have to embrace the fact that African-Americans, Latinos, Asian-Americans, and Pacific Islanders, and indigenous folks have to be a part of the decision-making, have to be a part of the prioritization design. And also, we have to begin to better fund our organizations that are out there on the ground, who's been there in communities for decades, working on shoestring budgets, and a lot of times getting more done than those folks who got $1 million. So that is the other part. If we truly want to win on climate, if we truly want to win on the environment, then that means that all these voices are going to have a place to be a driver, not just sitting at the table. Folks are going to have, you know, there's going to have to be some power sharing, and you're going to have to realize that All of these other great ideas and innovation that can come from diversity have to be a part of your process. And if it's not, then I just believe in real talk. We will not win on these issues because folks of color will remove themselves from the process and will continue to try and work on them through their own mechanisms and vehicles. And we need to come together. We have to break down these barriers, stop working in silos, and realize, as Dr. King once said, that we come to these shores on different ships, but we're all in the same boat now. So it's time for us all to start rowing in the same direction.
If folks are interested in learning more about the Hip Hop Caucus or wanting to follow the work that you do, how can they get in touch with you?
So for the Hip Hop Caucus, you can go to www.hiphopcaucus.org. You'll find a lot of information there. You can join some of our campaigns that are going on, or you can go to think100.info, which is another vehicle. And if you want to follow me, it's at EJNAction on Twitter.
Thank you so much again for joining me.
Thank you for having me, and continue the great work.
As I mentioned earlier in the episode, we are live from our 15th annual Legislative Policy Conference here in Washington, D.C., and I am joined by Mayor Dr. Karen Weaver from Flint, Michigan, to discuss environmental justice and environmental racism that is occurring in Flint. Thank you so much for joining me.
You know what? I'm glad to be here. I really am.
Some have called environmental racism the new Jim Crow. What does environmental racism mean to you?
You know what? It's so interesting because when I hear that, the first thing I want to say is Flint. That's the first thing that comes to mind because of what happened in Flint. It's such a good example of environmental injustice when you talk about water and water being a human right for everybody. And we shouldn't even be having this conversation in 2018. We shouldn't, especially for 4 years.
Right.
And that's another part of environmental injustice. It's taken 4 years and we're still working on this issue. We're still battling with the government that broke it and poisoned us to help us get this situation fixed. And one of the things we know is that if this had happened in a different community, community of a different color, different socioeconomic status, this would either it wouldn't have happened, or had it happened, it would be fixed by now. And so those are the things that we're concerned with. And that's such a good example when we talk about the environment and injustices that go on, especially in urban communities.
In what ways do you think that environmental racism impacts urban and rural communities differently?
Well, one is what we just talked about, the length of time it takes to even acknowledge it, let alone fix it. Because one thing we know is that we think if it had been another community and they held up brown water, people would have said, there's something wrong. But instead, we were looked at as if we didn't know what we were talking about. We aren't educated enough to know brown water is bad. And so even having our voices heard took a whole year and a half, and that should never be. So that's one of the differences, I believe, is no one wanted to hear what we had to say, or we weren't worth listening to. You know, which one is it? One and the same,
right,
is how it seems. But that's one difference, the length of time with which it takes for these issues to be acknowledged and then addressed. And like I said, and we're still working on addressing it.
Environmental racism and natural disasters critically impact communities of color, mm-hmm. but so do infrastructure issues. Could you give us a little bit of a primer on what happened in Flint to lead up to this water crisis?
Well, one of the things we know is infrastructure is a problem across the country. We do know that. And in Flint, we had an aging infrastructure like so with many other communities, an aging infrastructure that had not been invested in or maintained. And I think we were the perfect storm for what happened because ours, I think what made ours a little different was we had a governor that came in and did a state takeover and took away the voice and the democracy of the people. And so there was no power with the locally elected officials. So the mayor had no voice. The city council had no voice, really. And, when you look at what happened there, and it was something as simple as putting corrosion control in the water, But when that didn't happen to save some money, there was a protective coating that just was erased from our pipes, and lead was able to leach into the water, and that's how a whole community was poisoned because the infrastructure was old, it had been stripped, and they didn't do what needed to be done, what you would do in any community. And what really gets me is, how do you do this to when you know you have an aging infrastructure and you don't put corrosion control in and you don't test the water before you give it to people? But that's the issue, and that's why we're working really, really hard right now to get rid of all those lead service lines, because we had about 18,000 of them was our estimate.
And in what ways did the water crisis in Flint impact communities of color specifically?
One of the things is it's predominantly a community of color. So that's the big thing. And we still have a lot to deal with because we were dealing with other things before this. If you want to talk about, especially if you look at what was going on in Michigan, a lot of the urban communities had state takeovers. It was Flint. It was Detroit. It was Benton Harbor. It was Pontiac. So all of these urban communities had been taken over by Lansing, by the state, and decisions were being made about us by people that weren't from our community. So that was one of the first things that happened. What else did you ask me?
I was asking how it impacted communities of color specifically.
Yeah. So we were dealing with those kinds of issues anyway, having your voice taken.
Right.
You know, that was something. Having your neighborhoods not invested in, that was another issue that was going on in the urban communities. Having your assets taken from your community. Those were the things that we were dealing with as an urban community. And then you have this water crisis on top of it. So then you don't have access to things. You know, when you look at what was going on in the city of Flint in particular, one of the issues we struggle with is being a food desert. So many of the grocery stores have moved out. And when you're looking at urban communities and transportation is an issue, and we know that you need a certain diet to mitigate the effects of lead. And then you know, people of color and people of a certain socioeconomic status don't have the means with which to get to the grocery store to get the food that they need.
Right.
You know, we live in a climate where you don't have gardens growing year-round and you can't do, you know, that kind of thing either. So it really stifled our community and it really put us at risk for so many other things. You know, when you look at what was going on with the school system and having a crumbling school system, and all of these things were taking place in our urban community, and just not having access and being scared, actually, because, you know, we have a community that has really been lied to on every level of government, from our local, our state, especially, and federal government, and trying to rebuild trust is a really difficult, difficult thing when you've been abused in such a way.
What progress, if any, has been made in Flint?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. Because that's, you know, one of the things people don't hear about is the progress that we've made. And we have made a lot of progress as far as, you know, one of the things we started talking about were the replacement of the lead service lines. And our goal was to change 6,000 a year over the next, you know, every year for 3 years.
Right.
Because we had an estimate of 18,000. But we were ahead of schedule when we stopped last year. We had changed over 6,000 and looked at another 3,000. So we were halfway through changing those lead service lines, and that is going on right now. That started about 3 weeks ago with the lead service line replacement picking up. And so that's been a good thing. You know, people talk about the quality of the water and what's going on. And it's hard to understand because if you test our water, you'll probably get good test results. And we're really glad about that. But one of the things we know is when you have the amount of construction going on, you still have to protect yourself.
Right.
And that was why it was so important to keep the bottled water distribution in place for people to have access to that as we got through this process. So we have made progress. One of the other things that we've been able to do, I guess as a result of what has happened, is we did not have many school nurses at all. I think we had one for the whole district, so now all of our schools have school nurses. We were able to get some funding to replace some of the fixtures in the city of Flint, but we only got enough for about 4,000 homes, and we know we have way more than 4,000 homes, so that's something we're still fighting with the state about. But we're looking at not only fixing those lead service lines, but also some of the larger infrastructure, and we do have the funding to be able to do that. One of the good things that has happened recently is Kellogg, the Kellogg Foundation, really, I need to thank them because they had faith in us and had confidence in us and awarded us a grant to bring economic development back to the city of Flint. I mean, we had a city with no economic development department. So once again, the chamber was running economic development for the city. And so we've been able to bring that back to the city. And about a month ago, or maybe a month and a half, Lear Corporation started hiring people. Lear Corporation came to the city of Flint and invested $30 to $31 million and built a factory in the city. And it's the first time we've had a factory built in the city in over 30 years. And they're hiring people from Flint. Even when you look at the lead service line replacement, we've been able to hire people from Flint. And if they weren't those that weren't from Flint were from the county, at least, because we wanted to make sure that local people benefited the economic opportunities that we knew would come on the back of a crisis.
Right.
And it's been nice that we've actually been able to hire African-American companies, not all of them, of course, but they've been able to have a chance at the table, and that's something that wasn't happening. When you look at the construction companies, we have W.T. Stevens, and that was the first time that we've had in the city of Flint that an African-American company has gotten a multi-million dollar contract.
Wow.
We just had a hydrovacuum company owned by a black female named Martha Brown, and she was just awarded that contract. So those kinds of things are happening. So people are seeing that we are going to work in the city of Flint. And that was one of our fears, was that on the back of a crisis, that opportunities would come, but it would be the big companies coming in and making the money and then leaving when everything was done. And
right.
It's like, we cannot let that happen. And that's something that we haven't let happen. And so I hope people see that. I mean, Mott Community College is putting a culinary arts school downtown. So that's going to bring economic development opportunities. We are building up our riverfront and trying to change the perception of the Flint River, because one thing we know is it wasn't the river that poisoned us. It was people that didn't do what they were supposed to
right.
when they switched the source. And so we really want to change the way the river is viewed, and we're making it a river walk and putting recreational activities. We started a big environmental cleanup of the river last year, and that's with funding from the city, the state, the county, and the Mott Foundation helping to make that happen. So if you would come, you would see some things, some activities going on down there, and we're really looking to get into our neighborhoods, because we've been able to work on downtown, and there's still more work we know that needs to go on downtown to build it up, but we can't forget about our neighborhoods. And that's something that had happened, especially when you went into certain neighborhoods in the city of Flint.
Right.
And so we want to make sure that we're addressing those kinds of things. So when people come in, and well, even people that live there can say, you know, I see things happening. Things are getting better. Jobs are coming, and they see pipes being changed.
Right.
So those are some of the good things that are going on in the city.
Some folks deny that environmental racism exists because they think, oh, nature is nature and it impacts everyone no matter what they look like. But mm-hmm. what we know is that the choices that government officials make,
exactly.
the choices that our policies make have mm-hmm. deep implications on certain communities over others.
And that's exactly right. And a lot of times you'll see that they'll put profit over the public health and well-being of certain communities
right.
when you look at these kinds of things that are happening, whether it's nature or man-made.
Right.
That's what we know happens, because that was what happened in Flint, was it was putting profit over the public well-being, the public health of the people.
Right.
So not only did we have a water crisis, but an infrastructure crisis, a public health crisis, and it impacted us, you know, in all of those areas. It really, really did.
That's why it's so critical for our elected officials to look like the people that they're serving, because
exactly.
otherwise they won't have their
interests
at heart.
And that's why it's so important for people to get involved in local politics mm. and state politics. They want to come out and vote. Well, I don't know what they did this last presidential election. I don't know what happened. I guess they came and voted, and we didn't know who they were voting for. But it is so important for people to be involved in local and state politics, because that's where most of your day-to-day decisions that impact your life take place.
Right.
And a lot of times we sit down, and We can't do that. We really cannot do that, because you have to have people in there that care, and you need to know that these are the people that are going to be impacting your lives, whether it's council, whether it's mayors, whether it's boards of education, when you look at your state representatives, all those kinds of things, your governor. I hope that people are seeing that, because that's where a lot of decision-making takes place, is right there at the local level.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. What is your call to action for the movement for folks who want to help address this issue?
You know what? One of the things we've talked about, what you're doing right now is one of the things, is we need to keep the story of Flint out there, because we know Flint just represents so many other cities around the state and around the country, and especially urban communities, communities with high unemployment. So keeping this story front and center is really, really important, because how they treat us is how they'll treat other communities. And if it can happen in Flint, it can happen anywhere. But some of the other things I think people need to look at is keeping their elected officials, holding them accountable to make sure that they're doing what they say they're going to do. And if things can't happen, they need to have a good reason or explanation as to why and how. What are you going to do instead? I think, and I'm speaking probably for Michigan in particular, is looking at that emergency manager law, because that is a lot of how we got into the situation we got into when they put a law in place that you can have dictator come in and take over your city and one person making decisions. You know, it was interesting to me, because when I got in City Hall, I said, where's all the staff? Well, they had decimated the staff, but if you have one person making all the decisions, you don't need staff. So people need to pay attention, especially there, about that emergency manager law. Mm-hmm. But people need to, they need to be involved.
Right.
People need to be involved, and they need to speak up and speak out and recognize that their voice does make a difference. Because I remember when I got into office and I didn't have power, and they said, well, what can you do any differently from the past administration? I said, I can open my mouth and nobody can take my voice, and I can let you know what's going on, and if I can't change it, at least you know, and we will be in front of the media all of the time letting them know what is or is not happening in our city. And so being vocal and being active and being involved and engaged is it's just critical, and holding elected officials accountable.
If our listeners are interested in learning more about the work that you're doing specifically in Flint, where can they find you?
You know what? They can come to the city's webpage. They can come to Caring About Flint, because we are out there and we do want people to stay involved and in touch with what's going on in Flint. Because one of the things we hope is that people are using us as, it seems like we've become the poster child for good infrastructure and for water quality standards. So I hope people are watching us and staying in touch and learning from us and using what we have gone through to make sure it doesn't happen anyplace else.
Mayor Weaver, we are so grateful to you for speaking with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And before we wrap up this week's episode, we want to recognize an Urban League affiliate for their work to advance our movement. This week, we're shouting out the Fort Wayne Urban League for graduating their fifth class of participants for their BUILD program. BUILD, which stands for Building Trades, Urban League, Indiana Plan, and Local Diversity, is a program aimed at training people to become the next generation of skilled trades workers and to increase the cultural diversity of the skilled trades workforce. To learn more about the Fort Wayne Urban League, visit fwurbanleague.org. As always, you can follow us on all social media at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Play. Kudos to our communications and policy team here at the Washington Bureau and our editing team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to National Urban League's For the Movement. See you next week.